Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by Pinnacle Health Spine Institute, part of UPMC Pinnacle, offering a complete range of services to diagnose and treat your spine condition. More information is available at upmcpinnacle.com/spine.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Some of Pennsylvania's rural schools are struggling to provide meaningful educations for their students. Many of the issues rural communities are dealing with follow kids into the classroom. Financial stress in the home due to stagnant job prospects, a drain of young talent, and an opioid crisis with ripple effects that are devastating for young people. There are schools that are making changes, though, major changes, with the realization that they aren't preparing students for industrial jobs any longer. However, money is always a problem. Joining us is Keystone Crossroads reporter Kevin McCrory, who traveled throughout the Commonwealth, but especially northwestern Pennsylvania, to gather the stories of education, families, and students about the challenges of educating Pennsylvania's rural students. Kevin McCrory, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Kevin, what were you looking to find out or the stories that you wanted to tell about rural Pennsylvania, and especially the schools in the rural parts of the state?
You know, I cover statewide education, and, you know, often the headlines are dominated by urban districts, by action in Harrisburg, policy debates, political debates, and it felt to me that there was kind of a real gap in the coverage I read and in my own coverage of really getting to know some of the smaller rural districts in the state. And, you know, especially when we talk about state funding, there's always this debate about how money flows, and we have this thing called hold harmless, where districts that had seen population decline over time were protected. And there's plenty of reasons why that happened, but some of the urban districts often take issue with that. And so I felt like we were always talking about these rural districts without me personally ever having really been there and gotten to know them. So I just wanted to understand the challenges those districts face, you know, better and more personally. And so I started to look down the list, you know, where has population really gone down? Where are these districts that would be struggling with this deindustrialization? And a few superintendents were kind enough to really invite me in and show me around and give me a lay of the land.
Why northwestern Pennsylvania? I mean, you went specifically, to Titusville, which many people, if they know their Pennsylvania history, is where oil was discovered. That's what Titusville is most known for. You also went to a place called Corry, areas just south of Erie. Why northwestern PA?
Well, that's where the data really told me to go, right? That's where you see massive population loss. That's where you see, high poverty. You know, it kind of combined into, if you're going to tell the story of struggling rural Pennsylvania, there's a few places you could go, definitely, but that region certainly stood out as a highlight, and, you know, they were willing to have me come. So that definitely drove the decision there.
When you say that area really stood out, in what ways?
Okay, well, I mean, you know, when you go and you actually start to talk to people there and get a sense of the town, I mean, there's kind of two minds about it. You talk to people who are very optimistic about the future of the town, but also are very plain in saying the problems that have existed there. So, you know, clearly, you referenced at the top of the show, opioid addiction, drug addiction, meth addiction has been a problem in those areas, and it's something that you can talk to any random person on the street and they're probably going to bring up as a major issue in the area. You talk about poverty there, and it's different, of course, than you know, the urban concentrations of poverty that I often write about in Philadelphia or other big cities in the state. And you know, it's a different thing of you know, people living without plumbing, people living with dirt floors in their homes, people, you know, doubling and tripling up with families to be able to make ends meet. And you know, again, you talk to educators, and that's a consistent theme that, you know, hey, you know, you might look around here and it looks beautiful. And the area, of course, Northwest Pennsylvania, much of it looks beautiful. Allegheny National Forest and creeks and rivers and streams and rolling hills, farmland. But, you know, they say look deeper and you'll see that we are grappling with a lot of the issues of poverty that are maybe make themselves seem more apparent in the urban districts.
You mentioned, and I wanted to bring that up specifically, you wrote along with a police chief and also, I believe, the superintendent of Titusville, correct?
Sure.
And one of the things that you heard is that there were actually places where there still were people still living with dirt floors or without plumbing. I mean, that seems hard to believe in this day and age.
Yeah, but you know that you're talking about a very, very rural area, and you know, people living in, you know, it's common, I guess, and kind of generational there, and you know, certainly that's not the overwhelming story there. But I think their point was, hey, look, this still exists, as surprising as it may be, it still exists. And you know, you referenced the ride along with the police chief. I mean, that was very eye-opening in how, especially the drug crisis, can make itself present while existing amongst seeming normalcy. Right. So we're in a neighborhood of downtown Titusville that has many well-kept, you know, middle-class homes with, you know, proud homeowners, and amidst this, you know, we walk into this completely ravaged drug den, essentially, that had been squatted in by addicts, where, again, there is a child living there in that house. And, you know, my focus is thinking about how that crisis is affecting students and then affecting educators. And, you know, just, you know, the tour of the house that we went on, I think, was pretty and is pretty illustrative of the issue when you're thinking about just how much these issues bleed into kids' lives, how it affects their development, and then how they can bring those traumas into the classrooms, which then affect, of course, other kids, and educators have to figure out ways to you know, diffuse those situations and come up with ways to somehow combat that.
Well, let's get on to that then, because education is your main beat. And so just wanted to kind of describe the background of Titusville in northwestern Pennsylvania and ask that big question. How do these problems make their way into the schools?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear when you talk to especially some of the early educators. You know, you talk to the pre-K programs, and we should say Titusville was on the forefront of the universal pre-K idea and really implemented their program in the early 80s. So they've known that they have work to do with you know, young children for a long time, and they've been on the forefront of doing that. So, but you talk to those educators, you talk to educators in kindergarten, elementary school, and it's just a common theme. And, you know, I think one of the things that they felt is we really have to make school a place the kids feel at home in, that they feel connected to. It's not just, you know, a place where you go and you hear lessons for, you know, 5-6 hours a day and then you go home. They're trying to create this idea of community. They're trying to create this idea of stability. And, you know, I focused in the story on one of the more innovative, you know, potentially exciting models they've implemented, which is this idea of mass customized learning, which they put into place as a pilot program in the 2016-17 school year in one of their elementary schools.
No, what I was going to say, yeah, I want to talk a lot about that in just a moment. The sense I got from your stories, Kevin, is that Titusville, even though it is a small town, and is dealing with some major, major issues from the community, that the school district has kind of taken it on, that they realize there's a problem, and they have aggressively tried to address how their students are being impacted by this. Would you say that's accurate?
I think that's absolutely accurate. And you know, I think that we talk a lot in public education about neighborhood schools and you know, the idea of the school as the center of a neighborhood or the center of a community. And I think that makes itself very apparent in some rural areas of the state, and I'll speak specifically for Titusville, where you feel like you look around and where's the center? Where is that source of stability? And it clearly is kind of resting with the school district. The kids go there. The people who it's often the most educated people who grew up there who end up staying work for the school district, right? So there's a legacy there of adults who are trying to improve their community through education. And the people who've stayed, with so many jobs leaving, with so much population loss, the real anchors financially, intellectually of the community often are teachers and principals and educators. And that kind of creates this hub, which manifests in a lot of different ways. It's academically, it's, this stuff we're talking about, taking care of kids, but it's also just, it's socially, right? In the story, I was there during homecoming week, and you see the town coming out for homecoming parades, homecoming football. It becomes the prevalent story in town, and the school is right there at the center of that, and they have the chance to, really push the region in a different direction, and that's exactly what they're trying to do.
When we hear about many of the social problems of urban areas, cities that make their way into the schools, I mean, very often we hear about the majority of students living in poverty, or students who don't have breakfast or lunch that is provided at the school. In a way, and I wondered, tell me if I'm off base on this, but I wonder if maybe a smaller school district, a rural school district, is in better shape to address these kind of problems because they don't have as many students.
Yeah, I think that the concentration of the issue and the scale of the issue certainly, I think, allow for more direct and, maybe less bureaucratic abilities to kind of get at those problems, because you look at the issue in and of itself, it's the same in theory, but in a Philadelphia, in an Allentown, Lancaster or Harrisburg, there's just an exponential quality that happens with a concentration of it, where then if you have one school system that, instead of being in charge of 2,000 kids, is in charge of in Philadelphia's case, 135,000 kids, and that's the district, another 60,000 in charter schools in Philadelphia. You can understand how the scale there makes the challenges so much harder in the cities. Not to diminish the problems and the challenges in the rural schools, but I think that you're getting at something true, that there's an ability to affect change maybe more easily because there's just less people.
Maybe more easily, but probably in Titusville they're not thinking about it being
exactly
easier.
Exactly.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who is studying a new surgical technique that allows surgeons to make repairs to the heart without having to open the chest cavity and while the heart is beating. Info at upmcpinnacle.com.
Joining us for this portion of the program is Keystone Crossroads reporter Kevin McCrory, who recently wrote about his journey into northwestern Pennsylvania, Titusville, Corey, that area. We'll talk about Corey in just a few minutes. And what he found, some of the challenges that are facing rural Pennsylvania school districts and rural Pennsylvania overall. We should point out that even though Kevin focused on Titusville and a little bit later on Corey, that many of these same issues exist all over the state in rural school districts. So we're not just talking about northwestern Pennsylvania. Many of these same issues exist throughout the state. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question on WITF's Facebook page. and also on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WITF is part of the collaboration with three other public media organizations. To learn more about rural school districts and see Kevin's stories, visit WITF.org and click on Keystone Crossroads. Now, Kevin, earlier you mentioned about a truly unique thing that Titusville is doing. There are many stories like Titusville's throughout the state where heavy industry leaves and there's really nothing or very little to take its place to create jobs, or at least the kind of jobs that paid like those heavy industries. To their credit, Titusville realized that they couldn't go on preparing their students to work in jobs that no longer existed in their area. So what did they do?
Well, yeah, so I referenced this earlier, this idea of mass customized learning. And this is, you know, it's kind of part of a trend across the country right now where people are thinking about personalized education. And when you say that, that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And in some instances, it just means, you know, kids are on computers more, or, you know, yeah, they have their one-to-one laptops, or it could mean something else somewhere else. In Titusville, what it's meant is they've completely radically changed in this one elementary school. This is a pilot program. The concept of what it means to go to school. And typically, you know, when we think of school, it's okay, you're in first grade, everybody in your in the room is 6 years old, 7 years old, and there's a teacher in the front of the room and they deliver content. Some kids are going to get it, some kids are not. Try to give the kids who are not so much some extra help, and then you move on to the next next part of the textbook, for lack of a better word. What they said in Titusville, and in part of this mass customized learning idea, which is implemented in some other school districts in Pennsylvania, is that instead of having the idea of grades, let's have skill continuums. And instead of grouping kids by age or, again, grade, let's group them by where they fall on these continuums. So the idea is we're always challenging the kid to get better, no matter how good or bad, quote unquote, they are at the subject matter. We're meeting them where they are, giving them personalized help, and expecting them to prove a competency. We're not moving on until you can show me that you've mastered this skill. And that's just a pretty radical thing to pivot from in the traditional, you know, school. And so it takes, I think, a lot of buy-in from the entire faculty to have something like that happen. And what's interesting about the way it kind of happened in Titusville is the superintendent, Karen Jez, had started to read and you know, look into some of the research about this, you know, floated it to one of her principals as an idea that maybe they could try in some sort of a limited way. There was some conversation amongst the faculty, and the more that people kind of looked into it and thought about it, it really clicked, and it was the faculty who really pushed for it. The principal was much more wary at first of implementing the idea, but the faculty said, "We think this is really important. We think this is groundbreaking," and you know, convinced the principal to go in, and now she's kind of all in for it. And you know, it's not lost on them that they've seen the rise and fall of industry up close. And you know, when you think about the traditional school system that I kind of laid out there, it's often talked about as this quote-unquote industrial model, that the system it was designed in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to prepare students to, you know, move, you know, in lines, in bells, you know, with the bells ringing, in the same way that factories would move, preparing kids to learn how to, you know, accomplish a task and move on. And the new idea is that we need to have students become more creative thinkers, more problem solvers, more collaborative learners and experimenters. And so that's what they're trying to do there. I mean, and it's a difficult thing. There's a lot of skepticism. I think it can be oversold. At the end of the day, you know, you're going to want to say, well, do the kids still know how to read, write, do math? understand the scientific method, and so that's where you might look to standardized testing to show you, hey, is that happening? And so far, the results aren't flattering for this. It's only been a year that we have results on the books, but it's something that they're committed to, and they think at the end is going to mean they have kids who are more confident, who again are more creative, more collaborative, and they think in the future. Where we do so many things digitally, so many things remotely, maybe this can be the thing that revitalizes a region like Titusville. Yeah, the factory's not there, but if for the jobs of the future, if maybe this is the thing that we should be focusing on. That's what they believe.
Several questions, Kevin. First of all, I have to say that I'm a little bit surprised that when you say that this was the faculty that was really behind this idea and the principal eventually got on board, that I'm a little bit surprised that, and maybe they did, the state didn't have more of an input into it. Did they have to run this by any of the higher-ups in Harrisburg?
No, they did not. They have to. So I think for the state's reporting purposes, they have to have homerooms that count kids by grade, just to give an official attendance record. They have to, of course, meet state standards, and they have to, administer standardized tests in grades. So they do everything they have to do to kind of meet the state mandates. But outside of that, they have flexibility to organize their school how they want, and that's what they've done.
Well, you kind of touched on what I was going to ask next about if the kids aren't grouped by grades, how are they tested? I mean, do they basically do it by age, what grade they're supposed to be in?
So when state testing time comes around, they have to be back in their grade configurations. I mean, that's just the state mandate. That's the way it's reported. That's the way it needs to be reported, so that they comply with that. As far as your testing goes in a typical school, week by week, month by month, they're within their continuum, which is gauging how well they are at mastery of a certain skill or competency or knowledge area, and they're grouped along with people who are in the same boat as they are.
When you said that test scores were not flattering, did they go down, stay the same, or just what?
They went down overall, and you saw the kids who were considered at the lowest level, below basic. You saw more of those kids being considered below basic. Not dramatically in either case, not dramatically down overall, not dramatically up in that below basic category, but certainly trending in what you would think would be, not the right direction. Mm. So the superintendent would point out, well, that actually was the case at all of our schools in that year that you would look at. So it's not like this school with this pilot program is an outlier, and she believes again, it's 1 year of implementation of a new thing. Typically, educators will say any new, big dramatic change, you have to give at least 2, 3, 4 years. To have a chance of success and to really gauge whether or not it's working.
Let's take a phone call from Vince in Mechanicsburg. Vince, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
All right. First of all, disclaimer, I'm Vince Phillips. I'm the lobbyist for the Pennsylvania State Grange, and broadband access has been a real core priority for us. My comment is this. Although it's good to talk about differences in educational philosophy or innovative approaches to eliminating the grades or whatever, I think the core issue is giving the kids the technology tools they need to actually enter the job market in the future. And I think having broadband access, internet access to rural parts of Pennsylvania, I think that's critical to maintaining any type of an educational basis in that region. That's my comment. I'll take your reply off air.
All right, Vince. Thank you very much for your call. He anticipated one of my questions, Kevin. Does Titusville have broadband internet access?
I mean, the school system certainly does. Certain parts of the town certainly do. That wasn't something that was brought to my attention as a major issue in that area, but I'm sure that there are parts of the outlying rural parts of that district that probably do struggle with that. Wasn't something that was really that really came up a lot in the people that I talked to. But again, that doesn't mean it's not there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've talked about it many times on this program that that is a real challenge facing rural Pennsylvania. In fact, we're going to be doing our show live from the State Farm Show on Friday, and it is one of the issues that we'll be discussing because rural Pennsylvania, if it wants to be on an equal level with many of the urban districts in the state, do need access to broadband internet in many people's eyes. Change is difficult in education, and you described how we basically are going by an 1890s model. Often parents think, you know, and it's funny because this is one of the areas where parents will say, well, that's not how schools were when I went, and I turned out okay, or I got a pretty good education. What have the thoughts been from the community, the parents, on this new program in Titusville?
They seem largely receptive to it. I think that there's, like you said, there's always going to be people who raise those issues and feel like, you know, like you said, things aren't the way they used to be. But I think that there is a real recognition that something has to change. There has to be something has to spur something else to happen because they've seen over the past 30 years at least kind of this downward cycle of, you know, major industry leaving, job loss, again, all the things we talked about. They've seen it up close. You know, there are certainly good things also happening and other signs of encouragement. But it seems like, you know, at least in this community, the people I talk to seemed receptive and open to the idea that something needs to happen and why not try this?
Money is still an issue as probably, I don't know, 490 out of the 500 school districts in the state would say it is. So how does that lack of money, even with a new funding formula that may take a few years to fully implement, but how does that lack of money show itself in Titusville?
So, I mean, it's interesting. And in the money conversation, when you talk about some of the rural hold harmless districts that have kind of benefited from having the state, you know, continue to fund them at levels that, as if they had the populations they had in 1991, right?
Kevin, can I interrupt you for just one second? Can you explain hold harmless? I mean, you've talked about this on our program before, but just for those who may not be familiar with the term and exactly what it is.
So, yeah, in the early 90s, the state said, look, you know, we're going to have districts over the next, you know, year to year who are going to lose population, but let's not penalize them. Okay, they had 1,000 kids this year. If they go down to 900 the next year, we're not going to penalize them because it takes time. They're not going to realize the savings, right? And we don't want to penalize these districts even though they're losing enrollment. So that policy went into place, and it really stayed largely intact until just a few years ago when we implemented this new school funding formula. And so what you've seen over time is that, you know, if you were a district in 1991 that had 3,000 kids and now you have 2,000 kids you're still getting money from the state as if you had 3,000 kids, you know, that's great and for them. And, you know, there's certainly problems and challenges there that those educators would say, you know, we need those funds to address. But it created this kind of system of resentment across the state where you have some urban districts who maybe stayed pretty level in their population who feel like, hey, why are they getting, you know, quote unquote, all this money per pupil that we're not? You have districts that saw, you know, really fast population increases that said, wait, you're not, look, I used to have 2,000 kids, now I have 3,000 kids, you're still giving me money as if I have 2,000, but you're giving the district that used to have 3,000, now has 2,000 money as if they have 2,000. So you have this this resentment kind of growing, and so that was also part of my reason for going into these districts is to say, you know, there's so much finger pointing in these state debates about school funding. Let's see what the actual challenges are, and let's see what they say. And so when you go to their schools, it's clear that they've been able to use that hold, quote unquote, hold harmless money, right? The districts were held harmless to fund some pretty robust buildings, right? Like, you know, their schools look very nice. They're well kept. They have programs and resources clearly there that are benefiting kids. And you wouldn't go into their schools in Titusville, in Corey, and think, oh, you know, wow, this place needs help. You wouldn't think that going in there just economically, from what you can see. Whereas you go to some schools in some of the urban parts of this state, and you look at the school, and you walk in, you see the conditions that they're in, the staffing levels they have, and you say, wow, you know, they're clearly at a disadvantage. So there's that tension there, and that kind of gets back to this idea of poverty that we were talking about earlier, and concentration of poverty, and whose poverty is worse, and that debate is difficult to have, because we spent a large part of this program talking about all the problems and issues that Titus Hill and Corey do face. You probably could make an argument that that the problems are even greater in other areas, and the state is not giving them funding at the levels that would meet what they're giving per pupil, Titus Hill or Corey. So this new formula really starts to rectify that, but it's tough, right? Because then, as again, a Philadelphia and Allentown, a Stowe Rocks, a Shenandoah Valley, a Harrisburg gain, you have districts like Corey who are starting to see funds diminished.
Where is Corey, by the way?
So Corey is in, like, it's not far from Titusville. It's just north of Titusville, and it's in the southeast corner of Erie County. So it's about 45 minutes away from Erie City.
I got the sense from your report that Corey was, you said there were some school districts that weren't real happy with the amount of money that they were getting, that Corey even more so.
Absolutely, yeah. And the superintendent there, you know, is one really ringing the alarm bell for, you know, the way that the current formula is set up, and as we move forward in time, our budget is going to be affected year by year, and that means that we're going to have to continue to find things to cut, or we're going to have to continue to ask for more money from our local property tax owners, which is already a burden, especially in a town where, again, there's not a lot of opportunities currently. You've seen a lot of population loss, a lot of job loss, so they feel squeezed. They feel like, you know, in the state's attempt to make the system overall fairer. And again, this formula is bipartisan and, you know, universally, maybe I shouldn't say universally, but widely lauded. There's a superintendent of Corey saying, well, no, because for us, this is just squeezing us at a time when we see our student need growing. We see our residents feeling like they're already taxed to the max. And what can we do? We have our, you know, all the mandates that Scott, we've talked about in past shows, talking about pension and transportation and all the costs that continue to go up, healthcare for school districts. You have the confluence of all that, and at the same time, yeah, the formula isn't as generous to Corey as the old system. And so they're standing there saying, what are we going to do?
I'm curious, what kind of jobs do, I was about to ask where do they work, but what kind of jobs do people in Titusville and Corey have?
So there are still, you know, there are still factories, and there are still those sort of industrial jobs, but just not to the level that they used to be and not at the pay that they used to pay. So that's where you've seen a lot of people leave to try to find other opportunities. And in both cases, you know, there are very successful business owners who probably would be the highest paid people in town. The next level below that in both cases are going to be school district employees. And those school district employees make up, you know, a fair number of the high earners, quote unquote, in town, even though relatively, I mean, you know, they're clearly not still high earners in the way that you would think about it. But, you know, for a teacher who's maybe been in the district 10, 15 years and is making $60,000, $70,000, that's clearly a step above what most people in both of those towns are making.
Even though, you know, many of the heavy industries have left, not just Titusville and Corey, but many areas throughout Pennsylvania, there are, like, healthcare jobs, for example, to replace them. Is that the case in Titusville and in Corey?
Yeah, that's definitely that's a segment of it, and there was a new hospital built in Corey recently that you know, is employing folks, and you have you know, probably you have a lot of folks who work in Erie who commute all the way out to Corey, you know, 45 minutes, not too bad of a commute in the large scheme of things. So, you know, there's certainly opportunities. but still, again, not the opportunities that there used to be, and the place has just become less attractive to employers in general.
You know, we talked earlier, Kevin, about how Titusville in particular had turned away from preparing their students for those heavy industry jobs, oil, steel, maybe even natural gas. I don't know. Maybe there have been some job opportunities in that area. I'm a little curious what the curriculum looks like, how it's changed, other than the revolutionary curriculum or system that you described in that one pilot program, one elementary school. I mean, is there less emphasis on vocational education? They still need plumbers. They still, and we hear that all over the state, that, you know, many of the jobs, middle-class jobs that are going unfilled because students aren't being prepared for it. I'm just curious what the curriculum looks like.
Yeah, I, from a curriculum standpoint, I mean, we're in an era where, you know, districts are expected to align curriculums to state standards. So you're not going to see a lot of daylight between, you know, what Titusville and Corey are doing in their high schools versus a lot of other high schools across the state. It's just a matter of emphasis and expectation. But vocational jobs are, of course, still available, like you said, and can be some of the most valuable also in that area. So, you know, in Corey specifically, they're a remote district, right? It's 250 square miles, and so they built their own vocational wing. And it's an impressive facility. And this is one of the things I'm talking about when I say Hold Harmless money has helped them invest in things like that, which clearly are beneficial to them and their community. And the superintendent is actively saying, yes, I defend the program that we offer, but the less and less that we get, that means, you know, we have to cut and we have to, you know, scale back, and that program's not going to be there, you know, maybe 10 years down the line. But certainly there's a large emphasis there on vocational education. And, you know, you tour that facility and you think, man, they have everything they need in that regard. They're finding it harder and harder to afford it, but they've got, you know, the automotive shop, the mill shop, the daycare, you know, facility, nursing facility, you know, construction facilities, hydroponic gardening. You know, it's an impressive facility that I think would be envious of many schools. And what many schools do is they pool their resources. You know, you might have five districts who send their kids to a facility like that, centralized, that they all share. So Corey says, look, we're just so big, and our kids are already taking the bus on dirt roads hours a day, that I'm not going to send those kids back out on the bus in the middle of the school day. You know, after your English and math class, now you have to go, you know, be bused another hour to your VOTEC class. So that's why they built their own facility. But again, it's expensive, and it takes a lot of time and investment and resources to run something like that. And when they see less money coming in from the state, they feel like, wow, this is something that I don't know if we can continue doing. So what do? Do we scale it back, or do we ask more from our local taxpayers? And then there's that balance to strike.
Mm. Kevin McCory is with the Keystone Crossroads at WHYY in Philadelphia, covers education issues throughout the state for Keystone Crossroads. Interesting, Kevin, and I'm sure there's a lot to learn there for a lot of other rural districts throughout the state. Kevin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Last week, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection suspended all construction on Sunoco's Mariner East 2 pipeline, saying it has violated the condition of two kinds of permits. In particular, the $2.5 billion, 350-mile pipeline has been plagued by mud spills and well water contaminations. The pipeline will carry natural gas liquids from the Marcellus Shale in western Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio to an export terminal near Philadelphia. Joining us on the line from WHYY in Philadelphia is State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Susan Phillips. Susan, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Susan, how significant is this move by DEP?
Well, you know, it depends on who you talk to. a lot of people say this is pretty rare, that they would just halt construction. And I just want to clarify here that there's just been so much confusion about what that actually means. What it means is the construction that DEP had jurisdiction over and was able to permit, which included, you know, construction that went across waterways or wetlands and anything that had to do with drilling or anything related to earth moving or erosion and sediment control. Because I know a lot of people start calling us on Monday saying, hey, we're seeing construction in our neighborhood. What's going on? And what was going on is that the DEP actually doesn't regulate things like welding. That actually comes under the PUC. So there may be people out there who are seeing construction happening, and that's either having to do with welding or it has to do with securing and making sure that whatever was going on prior to the halt is not causing any more damage to the waterways.
Yeah, what you just described is a good example of why this is so complicated. Not just this, but getting these pipelines approved and actually getting them constructed and finalized and all that. Because, as you said, it's not just the DEP. There are a lot of other agencies involved in making these decisions.
It is, and it is confusing. And one of the unique things about this pipeline is it's not regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. And a lot of folks may have heard about FERC because they're overseeing things like the Atlantic Sunrise or the Penn East, but this pipeline is strictly regulated only by the Department of Environmental Protection and the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission, with some oversight by the Federal Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, PHMSA. But primarily it's DEP.
And you mentioned Atlantic Sunrise. That pipeline has gotten most of the attention here in central Pennsylvania. The Mariner East 2, it's a $2.5 billion project, 350 miles, goes from eastern Ohio through western Pennsylvania to Marcus Hook in southeastern Pennsylvania near Chester and south of Philadelphia. Let's talk about a few of the permit violations. One that got a lot of attention that was reported on by State Impact Pennsylvania this summer: well water contamination last July in Chester County. I think this kind of opened a lot of people's eyes, because not only were the residents upset and getting involved, but legislators got involved too, and it probably got some attention from the Wolf administration.
That's right. And the more we looked into it, Scott, the more we found that that what happened in Chester County was actually not unique. I mean, it turned out that there had been drilling mud spills, which the industry calls inadvertent return.
Yeah, that's a nice term.
basically, what that means is, you know, I guess it's harder to do a horizontal directional drill for a pipeline than I think anyone thought in areas, especially around Philadelphia, where you've got limestone formations, which are very porous. And what they use is what they call drilling mud, and it's not toxic necessarily, but if you have a lot of it spilling into a stream or a wetland, then it will smother aquatic life and damage the stream and wetland, and it can also damage people's well water. And we've seen that happen in Chester County, but we also saw that happen in other places in Pennsylvania, including Cumberland County very recently. And I think one of the reasons the DEP says that they had to shut down construction, at least related to this drilling, is because even though there was a court order instructing DEP to do things differently regarding the drilling, DEP found that Sunoco and Energy Transfer Partners, they're basically one and the same right now, had been drilling in places that they were not permitted to drill and had caused damage back in November. These issues around the horizontal drills, which, you know, it's important to note that the whole thing with horizontal directional drilling to lay pipeline was conceived of, or at least portrayed as more environmentally sound than just digging a ditch and putting a pipe in. So it's interesting that now we're having all these problems. And I don't think it's unique to the Mariner East. I mean, there's other pipelines across the country, including the Rover pipeline in Ohio that had these issues as well.
Yeah, I have to admit that when I saw your story and heard about the DEP learning about Sunoco drilling in areas where they didn't have permits to drill, I mean, there were a couple of things that came to mind. I mean, was this just a mistake on Sunoco's part? Were they doing it on purpose? And you know, it has to hurt the company's credibility in some people's eyes when they're drilling where they're not supposed to be.
They definitely have a credibility and a trust issue right now, at least with a lot of the residents that I've spoken to, either who have had to, you know, challenge the company through eminent domain takings or have had to deal with this kind of water contamination. And mind you, a lot of the people who, you know, woke up one morning last July and didn't have water or had muddy water, Scott, they didn't even lease their land to Sunoco, right? I mean, they didn't even have an easement. So they didn't even have a relationship with Sunoco or this pipeline. They just were in the path of this drilling mud and their aquifer happened to get, contaminated from it. Yeah, it's definitely caused a lot of issues in suburban Philadelphia, and a lot of the, you know, a number of lawmakers, as you said, have gotten more and more involved in trying to figure out, you know, what's going on, pressuring the Wolf administration. One of the things that they're doing now is trying to pressure the Wolf administration to do a risk assessment of the pipeline itself, because aside from the environmental damage it may do during construction, a lot of residents now who hadn't even been aware that this pipeline was going in their neighborhood are now worried about safety concerns of a natural gas liquids pipeline going through.
You've kind of touched on this, Susan, but what happens next after the suspension of construction?
Well, you know, what Sunoco says is that they're doing everything they can to comply with DEP's court order, which basically is just a long list of things that they have to do to prove to DEP that they will, you know, conduct their construction in a way that doesn't harm the environment and public health. And so they have a number of things they have to submit, some within 10 days, some within 30 days. And then, you know, then it's up to DEP to determine whether or not they can allow Sunoco to continue with those aspects of the construction.
DEP suspended the construction late last week, and you reported on it. Earlier this week, a report came out talking about the financial impact of the Mariner project on Pennsylvania. It came up with a figure that this would have a $9.1 billion financial impact on Pennsylvania. In what way?
So this report, I mean, that's a big number, right? I mean, that's larger than most big economic development projects in the state. So it's not as if, you know, that's a small number. At the same time, what you have to consider is what this looks at specifically, Scott, is really the financial gains. And so what they do is they take the budget, you know, the project budget, and they run models on it, and they figure out, okay, this is the amount of jobs, direct, indirect, or even less direct than that, called induced jobs, that this project would generate, and this is the amount of money, salary-wise, that this would generate, and here's the tax base that this would generate, and they, you know, add all those numbers up, and what they came to was $9.1 billion. And what they don't do, though, is look at what the pipeline may cost people, you know, and rather, you know, whether that's the environmental costs or social costs or the potential reduction in property values if people, you know, have had to sell easements to the pipeline. So they really don't look at that. So it's one part of the picture, right? It's one side of the coin. But one of the things that Sunoco told me was that right now on the pipeline they have about 2,500 people employed. Most of those obviously are construction jobs, good-paying union construction jobs. And a lot of those folks, as you can imagine, aren't working right now because of the work stoppage.
Mm. And so I'm curious, and I don't know whether you can answer this or not. Can those workers apply for unemployment compensation, or are they just not getting paid?
I assume they do. They're laid off technically.
Right.
Because,
yeah. But when you talk about those kind of ripple effects, I mean, this report even went down as far as the number of pizza shops that would sell more slices of pizza, and that's legitimate. But again, as you mentioned, what some people do wonder about the value of this report is, okay, if you're just going to show the financial benefits, you also should show how it's going to have an impact overall.
Well, yeah, of course, but you got to remember who paid for this stuff.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Itself. It's a legitimate firm that did the study, eConsult Solutions. They're in Philadelphia. They I trust them. They know what they're doing. But they do what the company told them to do, which is, generate the economic impact, the financials that are financial benefits of this project. As far as an economic cost benefit analysis, that's not what this study was. It still, it still gives you an interesting, and useful, some useful information, though, about, how the economic impacts of these types of projects and the value of having people put to work.
Mm. Hey, Susan, I'm almost out of time. Susan Phillips is with State Impact Pennsylvania. Susan, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WITF, WHYY, WESA, and the Allegheny Front to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about the Chesapeake Bay cleanup, another barometer.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who has offered transapical mitral valve repair procedures for more than 3 years and currently serves as a trial site for over 50 clinical trials. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.